Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
And a warm welcome to Dr. John Chute, who has stepped in this week again for Eamon Shanahan. You're very welcome, John.
Good afternoon, Deirdre. Good afternoon.
I'm just trying to see what microphone you're on. Say that. Say hello again.
Hello.
Ah, there you are.
There we are.
You're on guest mic one. John, thanks a million. Thanks for stepping in for Eamon. Eamon will be back next week, by the way. I know some of you have been asking after him. He's fine. He's only on a nice holiday for himself, and he will be back. But John, in fairness, John and David Buckley have been doing a great job of keeping the seat warm while he's away. Medical queries and general questions today. So if you have anything you'd like to ask John, send it in to us on 083 300 3300. And we'll start with this one, John, and it comes in from a male in his 70s, and he says he has athlete's foot. It started about 6 months ago. When he's in bed, his feet get hot and itchy. Local chemist gave him two creams to try, Dacterin and Caniston. No improvement. A few weeks later, went to his GP, who prescribed FLOCOL, whatever that is.
Fluclon. It's antibiotic.
That hasn't worked either. And he's been on it 3 weeks and he sees no improvement. He says, if anything, I think it's getting worse. He's not sleeping because it's so uncomfortable. Any suggestions as to what he could do next?
He probably needs to see a dermatologist at this stage, I would say, and get a referral from his GP for that. That's my way I would probably read of it, because he's got some resistance to treatment so far. And he might need an antifungal tablet, but they last for 3 months. It could be a bit of a nuisance to take for so long. But he would probably need to see a dermatologist at this stage.
Yeah, athlete's foot can be notoriously difficult to
get rid
of.
Very slow, absolutely, yeah. It's kind of ingrained in the skin and under the skin for quite some time before people get symptoms or see a rash or see the itch, or feel the itch, I should say. So it's there for quite some time before people do anything about it.
Yeah, and where'd you pick it up? Swimming pools and places like that?
Yeah, it's not just that. I mean, we see it a lot in this country because people, you know, with the type of weather we have, it's wet, it's moist. We go around wearing quite heavy footwear, you know, boots, dark socks. The people would sweat within, and you know, it's a perfect environment then for usually a fungal infection to grow. And as I said, it's there for quite some time usually before people start to approach either a pharmacy or their GP for that.
Okay, so he needs to go get
I would
a
say get a referral
to a dermatologist,
yeah, because it is resistant to treatment at the moment.
Yeah, okay. Now, this next one is from a listener. She's a lady who describes herself as an OAP in Killarney, and she's wondering, what causes leg cramps? I get them, but only in the morning.
The classical cause that was always told was that it's low calcium levels, but leg cramps can happen for people who may be deconditioned, where they're doing a lot of activity for the first time and they get crampy in the legs, so there's tightness on the hamstrings in particular and the calf muscles as well. But leg cramps can happen for no particular reason. Dehydration has been mentioned as well as a possibility. Inactivity, as I said to you before, or a few minutes ago there, where people suddenly become very active, can lead to cramping as well. It's where the muscles are, I wouldn't say deconditioned is the right word, but the muscles aren't as active as they used to be. And then when you go into a period of activity, you tend to cramp in the back of it. But it can happen to all ages. It's not just particularly to an older person. And as I said, sometimes, but not always, it's due to low calcium. And the treatment generally is quinine.
Tonic.
Tonic water, yes, that's the cheap version. You can get that anywhere. Or quinine tablets can be prescribed usually once at night. We tend to do the trick for it as well. But as I said, it's not just the elderly people, it's all ages.
And I can just anticipate that people will ask this, with quinine tablets, can you take it if you're on a lot of other medication?
I've never seen an adverse effect. I'm not 100% sure it has any major interactions or anything else. But when it comes to the elderly, you do have polypharmacy, where people are on a number of other medications, whereas with younger people, that they tend not to be on anything. But usually quinine tends to work at 200 milligrams or 300 milligrams at night. But people can always try, as you said, their tonic water to start off with and go from there.
Okay. Now, this next one is from a listener who has a 15-year-old daughter who gets bad migraine before her period. She's not taking anything, only takes Nurofen.
Yeah.
What is best for her?
There's a few things here. 15-year-old daughter tells me that probably mom or mom's mom has migraine. There's over 500,000 cases of migraineurs in the country. Usually it's family predisposition, and it's also female predisposition as well. So for a 15-year-old, you can treat it with anti-inflammatories or simply paracetamol in mild cases, but more than likely may need to go to a migraineous tablet. They come under the kind of category, we call them the triptans, there's four or five different ones, but they're all reactive, so you take them in reaction to the migraine attack. So therefore, you can go a little bit further and maybe get a prophylactic medication, which sometimes might be a beta blocker for a 15-year-old, a little bit slow to do it, and if she was a little bit older, you might even consider going on the pill as well to reduce the intensity of her periods, because obviously it's been triggered by the period.
Yeah. So it's hormone-driven, is it?
Hormone-driven in her case, but migraine can come on for a variety of reasons. Lack of sleep, certain foods can trigger it, but they all have one thing in common. They tend to all be family history in some shape or form.
And how would you know a migraine from a regular headache, John?
A migraine would give you sort of classical settles in dark rooms. Light makes it much, much worse. And then you have associated features either of vomiting or nausea, or you have visual disturbance as well. And they often get a kind of a lead into it as well, where people feel it's coming on and then they get the visual loss or the nausea with the headache. So it's all kind of an anticipatory. And then there may be a certain pattern to it like that with the menstrual cycle in certain people. But usually people know they have a migraine and it's really intense and they have to retire into their bedroom and stay there for a day, 2 days to leave it run its course.
Yeah, that's very debilitating.
Yeah, very, very debilitating. Like I said, you know, it's about one in, I suppose, one in seven or eight people in the country right now have a history of migraine, which is very debilitating. But like I said, when we get the medication correct for it, be it a prophylactic or a reactive medication, you tend to be on them for life. The triptans, which would be the reactive ones, people tend to take them. They're if and when it happens, and then the prophylactic, like a beta blocker, like I said, or sometimes maybe, in this case, maybe thinking about the pill if she's a bit older, they're every single day then. But it is a very debilitating condition.
Okay, now, next up, this is actually a very interesting one from Sarah. She says, I'm a healthy 62-year-old. I don't smoke and I'm fairly fit, but this is my fifth head cold this year. I get runny nose, headache, and I'm constantly knackered tired. Could Dr. Chu tell me why I'm constantly picking up head colds? I feel I'm healthy, but I always seem to have a cold.
Well, if you look outside, it's sunny and it's the first day in a while. I've seen an awful lot of recurrent respiratory tract infections in the past 6 months. We're just not getting good weather, and it's this constant dampness, darkness. People are just getting over one, and the weather isn't conducive to improvement, like able to, you know, enjoy vitamin D, for example, getting out to the sun, exercising, etc. It just seems to be this particular autumn, winter into literally a day or two ago that people are getting recurrent respiratory infections. I'm still as busy now as I was back in December.
Which wouldn't be normal.
Wouldn't be normal at all, no. And I think it's definitely the climactic effects, the wet. It was very, very cold at the weekend, just gone by. Very windy. I mean, Saturday was very, very wet. People are going to be picking up respiratory infections because they're going to be huddled together, you know, not out and about. So the transmission is much easier as a result. And that, unfortunately, is the reason behind it.
Yeah. So is there anything she could take to prevent herself getting more colds?
I always tell people to take vitamin C, particularly because it's very helpful against viral infections. So daily vitamin C would be, you know, capsule form, for example, or you just take it in freshly squeezed orange juice. Obviously, don't smoke. Get vaccinated. Going back to last October, for example, to get the flu vaccine, and just try and live as healthy lifestyle as possible. I did mention vitamin D, which is very, very good for your immune system as well. And then, if you get significantly worse very quickly, obviously see your doctor. You may need a course of antibiotics at that particular stage, but as I said, I think it's very much the type of weather we've been experiencing for the last 4 to 5 months.
Yeah, so maybe from today onwards, looking out at the sun, Sarah might feel a bit better. We've a listener, I don't know what, oh, this is a woman, sorry, I beg your pardon. This is a 74-year-old lady, and she says her problem is she's waking at night multiple times with a very dry mouth. She has tried different types of gels and drinking water. Any further advice?
Dry mouth, sometimes it's medication related, so she hasn't mentioned that. It happens to a lot of people on the back of certain medications. And then the second thing would be, possibly, I was just saying, it could be a thing called Sjögren syndrome, which is where you get a lack of saliva. And as a result of that, then the mouth and the tongue feels parched all the time. That's possibly the reason here. That's usually an autoimmune mediated condition. Again, happens in females. I've got one patient with it, and very, very debilitated because they have this continuous feeling of dryness all the time in their mouth, and you just have to drink water and keep it as moist as possible. May need to see a rheumatologist if there's other conditions with that, such as joint pains, dry skin, sometimes dry eyes, fatigue, lethargy, and so forth. It may be an underlying rheumatoid condition as well.
So she needs to get that checked out.
Yeah, I'd see her GP over that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, John, we're going to take a break at this point to give you a breather and to let some air in, because it's very warm here in the Radio Kerry Roamer outside Rose Hotel. But do keep those questions coming in for Dr. John Chute. And remember, you can text them through to 083 300 3300, or indeed phone Brenda, who's taking the calls back at base on 066 712 3666.
Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
Now, in case you've only just tuned in, we're outside the Rose Hotel celebrating their 10th birthday, and we'll be meeting more staff members from the hotel a little later on in the programme. For now, though, Dr. John Chute is with us for Medical Matters, and we're taking your general queries. Now, since we were talking about antibiotics and chest infections before the break, John, this next one is from an 89-year-old female, and she says, when should you start to see an improvement after taking steroids and an antibiotic for 4 days due to chest infection?
She should have seen an improvement by now. I'll go with the antibiotic first. As a rule of thumb, now I could stand to be contradicted on this one, but Jenny's rule of thumb, I tell my patients 48 hours. It goes for all antibiotics, urinary tract infections, for example, skin infections, respiratory infections. If you're started on an antibiotic, you should start seeing some clinical improvement after about 48 hours. With steroids, they're very slow relative to other tablets. It takes about 8 to 10 hours for them to start kicking in. And again, you should start seeing a difference after 1 to 2 days. With kids in particular, with steroids, and I might prescribe maybe a 3-day or 5-day course for children, parents have told me time and again, it's after 1 or 2 days that they're 100%. They really improve dramatically. So she should be feeling a lot better after 4 days. And if she's still symptomatic, she needs to go back to her own GP on this one. You should have an improvement by now, absolutely.
And her GP might, what, try a different antibiotic or something?
Yeah, try a different antibiotic, nebulization for sure if it's respiratory infection, and get a chest x-ray as well if a chest x-ray hasn't been organised. I wouldn't always dive into a chest x-ray on just one visit, but where you have repeated respiratory infections or where you have a very slow or non-resolving infection, you should be getting a chest x-ray at that particular stage.
Now, this next one is from a listener who says, my 90-year-old dad has an area in his back that gets extremely itchy, especially at night time. He is on 1% of Betnovate ointment. Could he get anything else to help? He thinks that eating an egg every day doesn't help.
Well, eating an egg won't do any harm, I would say, unless he's allergic to it. He could probably change from Betnovate to a stronger product. There's Dermavate there as well, and Elecon. There's one or two out there he could try. And if the steroids are all steroid-based, if they don't work, you could try something like Protopic, which is tacrolimus, which is another different type of product, if it's an isolated area. It sounds like a patch of dermatitis is what he has.
Okay. Now, I'm not sure about this next one, but this listener wants to know, what collagen capsules would you recommend for a woman? Yeah, there's a huge marketing.
I can't answer that.
Drive.
I can't answer that. I think you need to go to see your pharmacist. By all means, take them. I mean, we do start losing collagen as we get older. It's called sarcopenia. So it's thinning of everything, muscles, skin, bones, obviously, would be osteopenia. But she could speak to anybody in a reputable pharmacy or even a health food shop on that one.
Yeah, it's the big thing at the moment now. Everybody's talking about collagen for women. Now, a listener wants to know, how do you get rid of fungus on the big toenail?
Usually it's tablets. We had this type of question there at the very, very start. People have often put on nail lacquer on the toenails of their big toe, but usually that's absolutely a waste of time. You have to go oral on this one. And there's only one product out there, which is Lanifine, which is terbinafine, 250 milligrams once a day for 3 months at least, maybe 4, and sometimes a little bit longer. But usually 3 to 4 months of one tablet a day every day will treat and cure that. You won't see any visible improvement for about 2 months. It's a very, very slow process.
Now, here's one that will make you smile, I think, John, from a 72-year-old lady. She says, I'm a very nervous patient. Whenever I have to go to the doctor, my blood pressure goes off the Richter scale. Yeah. Any tips on how to keep it down?
Okay, so first of all, she's got white coat syndrome. There's no doubt about that, which people are probably aware of. Gets its name from my former colleagues back in the day used to wear white coats, but not anymore. And people's blood pressure subconsciously just shoots up. It could be a doctor, it could be a nurse, it could be outpatients, it could be a GP setting, could be anywhere, but it does not happen outside of that setting. So therefore, she needs to get a 24-hour blood pressure monitor put onto her, which nearly every GP practice would have at this stage. It's covered by the medical card scheme. And what happens is that you get fitted with that by the practice nurse usually, leave, do your day-to-day business then, and every half an hour during daytime hours and once an hour at night, it'll take multiple readings. And then you come back in and it's downloaded onto the computer and your blood pressure should show normal readings outside of the immediate start and outside of the immediate end, usually with a drop at nighttime. That proves beyond doubt then that your blood pressure is normal. That's the gold standard.
Okay. I'd imagine it'd be very hard to sleep with a blood pressure monitor.
You'd be surprised. Most people do. And I share your thoughts on that one. The you know, you see this sort of device on your arm. It's like an old Walkman of old. But now we've just purchased a wireless device. And people sleep perfectly with it. And the device will go off every hour. Right in the middle of deep sleep. And if you see at least a 10% drop in blood pressure during the night, it proves you don't have resistant hypertension, which is there 24/7. So it's very, very reassuring. Ironically, a couple of weeks ago, I had a patient in who sky-high blood pressure in front of us, sky-high blood pressure on repeated readings, nailed on to probably start blood pressure tablets. And then we did a 24-hour, and of course, the readings were perfect. So it saves a patient having to be not prescribed a blood pressure tablet or tablets, because their readings are taken outside of a GP or a nurse's situation.
So white coat syndrome is extremely common.
Very common, yeah, absolutely. And anybody gets it. It's not just unique to males or females or the elderly or whatever.
We're all terrified of you, John.
Thanks.
not at all. Next question is for somebody who wants to know, what's the best thing to do for, I can never say this word, is it sciatica?
Sciatica, yeah.
It looks like it's, how is it spelled?
S-C-I-A-T-I-C-A.
Oh, so the C is silent. So it's not sciatica, it's
sciatica.
Okay. I don't know what age this person is, but they want to know what's the best thing
We're talking about, white coat syndrome being extremely common. So sciatica, I'd see a case a week, I'd see at least. And sciatica, again, can happen to anybody. It's a spontaneous onset of back pain in the lower back, which radiates down to the gluteals or the buttocks and further on down to the back of the thigh, down to the back of the knee. And then in more people, it'll go even further down to the back of the heel and sometimes onto the foot itself. So the giveaway is that it's usually spontaneous onset. There's no history of trauma. There's no falls here. People will get it acutely. It comes on and it's extremely painful and debilitating. And when I see cases in my surgery, they're often the person standing in the waiting room. They cannot sit down. So they come in, their walk is affected. They need to stand. I examine them while they stand. And there's a couple of trigger points in our giveaways, and they always have a history that it came on suddenly the previous night. And usually, but not always, it's due to the fact of one of the two disc spaces in the last space, which is the L5-S1, or the second last space, the L4-5, the disc has come out and pressed on the nerve root there. And in turn, that radiates the pain right down to the back of the knee, the ankle, or to the base of the foot. And it's very debilitating. The good news is that over 90% of them recover spontaneously. The bad news is that it may take several months. And then that small number, that 10% or less, need to go on to see my colleague in the Bonds here in town or elsewhere for sometimes a nerve root block because tablets have failed. And then another percentage of that will fail again with nerve root blocks needing to go for surgery, which would be either a partial discectomy or a thing called a laminectomy. So it's very, very debilitating. But like I said, you have an over 90% chance that at about 6 months it is cleared for good and it can recur, which is
unfortunate.
Yeah.
Okay. Now this next one is from. Let me see. I think we had another. We had a sinusitis question. Oh yeah. Yes. This person got sinusitis in January, and a milder dose of it recently. I didn't need antibiotics, but my sense of smell and taste are gone since January. Will they come back?
They will come back. Again, going back to that lady we had before the break about repeated infections, I'm seeing sinusitis again and again and again. And it's a very debilitating problem in those who get it. If you've never had sinuses, you don't understand just how bad the pain can be. It's usually out through the eyeball, lack of smell, a real intense frontal headache. You feel absolutely lousy. It's a low-grade kind of fever. You don't really get very much spiking. You've no spiking, no chills, but you just feel lousy. It's like a really bad head cold, but it's not going away. And then in the acute setting, we tend to give antibiotics, which will clear it. Nasal decongestants are very often prescribed to keep it away. And then in this particular case, if it's still recurring, you stay on the nasal decongestant and probably start an antihistamine therapy with that. Antihistamines obviously are there for, say, pollen exposure, which may give you sinusitis, the hay fever that we all know about, but we can use them for infective exacerbations. And then if it continues to persist, and I've had two or three in the last couple of months, we tend to do a CT scan on them to see if you have any evidence of chronic mucosal disease, it's called. And if it comes up positive, you might need to see my ENT colleagues for some surgery to try and clear it for good.
And is surgery usually successful?
Yeah, surgery is successful. And again, you're talking about the tip of the iceberg here. It's still the small little percent of people. But that's where they get three or four episodes, always bounce back after antibiotics, and then three or four months later, they're back again. And if that persists for a number of years, you tend to have to go on to the ENT. Colleagues at that stage.
Okay, very good. One more before we let you go, John.
No problem.
And this is from a lady in her 50s. And we're back to blood pressure again. She took the blood pressure monitor. The readings were normal, but a few times they showed up with possible cardiac arrhythmia. What does that mean?
Okay, so your heart should beat regularly all the time. And it will beat at a certain rate depending on how fit you are. And it would go up at that rhythm, say after running or jogging or under stress, and then come back down to its baseline again and obviously fall at night. However, sometimes it may flip into irregular beats, and we call that atrial fibrillation. And when it's really bad, it may be paroxysmal from time to time, or repeated, so it's a constant. Or you may get ectopics as well, which are these extra little beats, extra systoles, which are added in. These are benign, and it would be picked up on an ECG tracing as well. And generally speaking, atrial fibrillation needs to be treated, and extra systoles don't need to be treated. But a cardiology opinion should be sought on both cases. And that's maybe what's been picked up.
Okay, very good. Well, look, John, we leave it there. We got through some amount of questions today and plenty of variety, that's for sure. But thank you so much.
Not at all.
For stepping in, not just this week, but indeed a few weeks back as well for Dr. Eamon Shannon. And thanks to Dr. David Buckley as well, who was with us and filled in a few times. Eamon is back next week with Medical Matters. For now, though, we'll say goodbye to Dr. John Chute. And we've more guests for you to meet in our Radio Kerry Roamer after these.